Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us for this week's edition of the Northwest Passage. I'm KLCC News Director Rachel McDonald.
I'm Morning Edition host Annie Katz.
I'm reporter Brian Bull.
And I'm reporter Chris Lehman.
We'll get an update on the legislative session from Chris in just a little bit and hear from Brian about his latest stories. First, Annie, what were some of the top stories this week on KLCC?
So let's start with the census, because that's something we hear about in national news and also this week in local and regional news. Mallory Begay did a story this week about how the 2020 census could undercount up to 32,000 minorities in Oregon. Latino and Hispanic populations are most at risk, which is fueling criticisms over the addition of that citizenship question, which has been getting a lot of attention. Now, if you were paying attention last week, there was a really banana story in the New York Times about a deceased Republican strategist, Thomas Hoffler. His estranged daughter found a trove of documents on his hard drive that essentially lay out a Republican plan that shows that by adding a citizenship question, it was a tactic to gerrymander districts to the Republicans' advantage. Oregon Senator Ron Wyden wants an investigation into this.
That a Republican political operative clearly worked to undermine the purpose of the census with the explicit goal of undercounting communities of color to the benefit of his political party is simply outrageous.
14 Democratic U.S. senators, including Wyden, want an official review on suspicion that Republicans knew the census would undercount minorities. The U.S. Supreme Court is weighing a decision on the constitutionality of that citizenship question, and a ruling is expected sometime this month. And obviously, it's on an accelerated timeline because that census needs to get out into the mail.
It really raises some questions because the justification up to this point has been that this was something to strengthen the Voting Rights Act. But if this bears out, it seems like there's a more ulterior motive, I guess.
There was another story. We got a visit from KLCC's Tom Bonsi. He reported from Eugene this week about next generation 5G cellular service. You've probably heard about this, maybe in ads online or just in the news. And I have to summarize it really delicately because it is a little bit of a controversial issue, kind of like vaccines. So basically, 5G cellular service at peak speeds is supposed to be 20 times faster than our current 4G LTE that we have on our phones. But activists here in Eugene and also in several other communities in the Pacific Northwest are asking city or county governments to defy the federal government, which is kind of going on this plan right now to install it everywhere very quickly. And they want to stop deployment of 5G. Essentially, they believe the safety of this new technology is unproven. And here's a local activist, Josh Korn, making a very sarcastic point in front of the Eugene City Council.
I've changed my opinion on this, and now I fully support 5G because I want more cancer, more disrupted sleep, more adrenal problems, more reproductive problems, more birth defects, more compromised immune systems.
The millimeter wave frequencies used for 5G carry way more data than current generation cell service, but the radio waves don't travel as far. So the reason why people are upset about it is that wireless carriers need to deploy thousands more of these new small cell transmitter antennas, and they're going on top of power poles and streetlights about every six blocks in Eugene. These are in neighborhoods, these are near schools, businesses, so people are nervous about them.
Mayor Lucy Vinnis, mayor of Eugene, did mention to Tom in the story that those are not yet operational, and I guess it hasn't actually launched, but
right.
But yeah, the infrastructure is being built.
Yes, and I think I kind of have to bite my tongue to offer further commentary on that. Go ahead, Brian.
I think I can safely comment, though, that as long as there have been such things as radio waves, microwaves, and cellular data, that there have been concerns raised about potential health risks. So this is something I think is a new chapter to an ongoing century-old concern.
Absolutely.
And right now, we are in a radio station. We're absorbing radio waves,
oh
right?
Oh, my God. about these microphones.
I thought I felt a rustle.
And lastly, as we are heading into this hotter time of year, we had our first major wildfire in Washington State right now. It's being called the 243 Command Fire. It has grown incredibly fast. Yesterday morning, that's Wednesday, it was 5,000 acres. This morning, it was close to 19,000 acres.
Wow.
This area in Grant County, Washington is really dry. It's the usual suspects of wind, difficult terrain, and dry vegetation that's making it a challenge to fight. And, you know, there's not more to say other than this is just a reminder of what will be a very severe wildfire season in our region this summer.
And kudos to our correspondent, Anna King, who's been bringing us some really great information about the fire.
Yes, absolutely. She's been on the national news as well.
I just want to mention, you know, you mentioned the weather, and we are getting a little relief right now from the grass seed pollen, which is at its peak in the Willamette Valley. This is the season for allergies. And over the weekend in Eugene and the Willamette Valley, it was measured at 526 parts per cubic meter for grass seed pollen, where 200 parts is considered very high. So that's a lot of allergens in the air. A little bit of rain possible this week, which could clean things out, but we won't really get a break until the end of the season, which is usually around July 4th.
This is like, we're number one. We're number one.
Yeah, for allergies.
Yay.
Yay.
It's definitely, I'm not an allergy sufferer usually, but I think it's so bad that one of my eyes will just start weeping for like 2 hours, and it's very irritating.
Well, I was inspired to do the story because I looked at Chris Hack, our engineer, and he looked like he was crying. And I said, are you okay?
Oh.
He was like, oh, yeah, allergies. So I just felt for him. Oh. Yeah.
So he's not sad about equipment breaking or anything.
That too.
I started my allergy regimen back in March. And that's when some people like myself were very prone to allergies are advised to begin.
Wow.
So yeah, an inhaler, loratadine tablets, and I'm coasting through just fine, but in past years I've been just flat on my back after a sneezing fit, and sometimes those attacks for me last up to 5 to 10 minutes, and blows you out of proportion. It just really knocks you. I was reeling for a long time with the teary eyes and the runny nose, and it's pretty miserable. And so I guess between neighboring Linn County being grass seed capital of the world, not
Yay!
That I resent that, Linn County, but also the geography of the Willamette Valley keeps a lot of these particulates in the valley. It really has nowhere to go, so it kind of just settles. You think about maybe in July or August as the wildfire smokes begin to come in through the valley too, you're going to have this very unique mix. But saying that too, come 4th of July is usually when most people feel that the grass pollen count is at its lowest and it's done for the year. So we got that to look forward to in less than a month.
Chris, do you have allergies?
I do not, fortunately.
Lucky, lucky.
Yeah, I'm one of the lucky ones, too.
Good for you.
Just rub it in, guys. Whatever.
Good for you. Well, one of the stories I looked at this week had to do with hazelnut farmers are getting $11 million through a new disaster relief bill that is headed, at this point, to President Trump's desk. This is the $19 billion bipartisan disaster relief package. And this helps growers across the U.S., but here in Oregon, we have our hazelnut farmers. These are growers who've suffered damages through natural disasters like storms, wildfires, what have you. In this case, the late February storm that dumped over 18 inches in 2 days, that really affected a lot of hazelnut farms across the Willamette Valley. I talked to Gary Rudakowski of the Oregon Hazelnut Commission, who operates a 60-acre hazelnut farm in Vida, who's guardedly optimistic about the money.
I have to say, in my 50 years as an orchardist, it's the first time that government funds have been available for disaster relief in the hazelnut industry. Since the president's signature, I'm optimistic, but I'm not assured that he will sign it. I'm a little bit hesitant to go and make the leap that we're going to get this money.
Rudakowski has just passed the halfway mark in cleaning up his hazelnut plantation. He figures his harvest will be roughly half of what it's been this year. perhaps even more due to the damages he took on during the big winter storm. The majority of U.S. hazelnuts are grown in Oregon. 80,000 acres are used for this purpose. Rodakowski also added that the trade war of China has affected farmers nationwide. This includes almonds, corn, soybeans, and, of course, hazelnuts. He says before China and the U.S. began exchanging tariffs, he was making $1.80 a pound. The most recent price is roughly a third of that.
Wow.
That's crazy.
They need that relief.
They do. Winemakers, by the way, are getting $3 million from this package, and I know that for a lot of growers here in Oregon, wildfire smoke really tainted the vineyards.
Yeah. And Brian, you also reported on a couple threats that we heard about at schools in our listening area.
Very much so. We're nearing the end of the school year here in Oregon. I don't know if that's necessarily behind these, but two did happen this week where students left threatening or vaguely threatening messages. We had a report coming out of Oregon State University. The Valley Library was evacuated and closed after people found a whiteboard message that implied something ominous. Investigators concluded that there was no credible threat behind it, and people were able to come back a few hours later. And then about a day or two later at South Eugene High, a student used social media to tell another student not to come to school the following day. This was then shared with police. And then after some investigation, it was concluded that this was essentially a very bad joke, and the student who sent it was arrested. I've talked to police in recent years about how these incidents come and go. This has become a pretty routine problem. Social media, especially, has really exacerbated these types of calls. Misinformation and threats can go viral with very little effort but to, you know, type and click. And no agency or individual wants to be the one that shrugs it off as a prank at first glance, so there is a need to respond. But schedules are disrupted, personnel and resources are committed, and perpetrators of these threats, real or not, are breaking the law and can face actual consequences. So I'm not a fan of TPing anyone's yard or taping someone's locker shut, but these are more time-honored pranks that cause relatively less harm and won't land you any time at the juvenile center.
Yeah, I have to admit, while I was reading the story that you wrote about the South Eugene threat, I was, you know, I actually didn't know that the student was arrested. And I don't know. I think as someone with two kids in public school, it's nice to see that the police are taking these things seriously, even if it was just a bad joke. Next time, maybe put a teacher's car in the gym or something. Don't actually do that, but, you know, I think those are the more time-honored pranks.
Yeah. And the police also commended the student for coming forth with it. They were unsure about it, so the student told their parents, the parent told the police, they worked with the police to look at the message. It was anonymous. It was using an application called YOLO, I believe, which may be an extension of Snapchat, but there are ways to actually trace the origin of even anonymous messages. So, yeah, in short, don't do it.
Well, Chris, you've been in Salem all week, and it's been a busy week. Can you tell us what's been happening with the legislature as it tries to wrap up this session?
Sure. They have a few more weeks before they have to get things done, and on their must-do list remains several of the larger agency budgets, as well as the higher education budget. That was supposed to be considered at a budget subcommittee meeting this morning, and then it was mysteriously held over until Monday, so we might get a better sense early next week of what universities and community colleges can expect from the state legislature in terms of funding. A number of other bills passing through that aren't budget bills but are of interest to various groups of people. There was a bill about the National Popular Vote Compact. That's been an idea that's been around for more than a decade now, and the Oregon House has voted to join that compact many times, but finally this year the Oregon Senate and the House both agreed to do it. What it would do, it would pool Oregon's Electoral College votes along with votes from other states that have joined this compact and award those Electoral College votes to the winner of the national popular vote. So if this were to go into effect, we would no longer have a case where the winner of the national popular vote does not become president. We've had that happen two times in the past 20 years. It still needs a number of other states before the compact would take effect, so we're unlikely to see it for the next election cycle, but that is something out there. there now. The governor is expected to sign that bill when it gets to her desk in the next few days. Another interesting bill that went through the Oregon Senate this week is a bill that would ban coyote hunting contests. And I should just say that I grew up calling them coyotes. Some people say coyotes. I might flip back and forth here. But it was one of those bills that shows the urban-rural divide in Oregon. Democrats, who largely voted in favor of the bill to ban these contests, they tried to establish their bona fides on rural issues, saying that, you know, it's okay that I'm voting for it. I do know about rural Oregon. We had Senator Lee Beyer, a Democrat from Springfield. He reminded everyone that he grew up in rural Nebraska. He knows a thing or two about hunting predators. On the other hand, Republicans kept reminding everyone how rural their current districts are. They said, you know, city folk just don't understand how much of a problem coyotes are for ranchers who frequently lose livestock, especially young livestock. And then we had Republican Senator Fred Girod. His district includes a large swath of eastern Linn County, a very rural area. And he just wanted to make sure that everyone knew how much affection he had for coyotes.
I actually like coyotes. It sounds kind of corny, but I think I'm the only person I know that has run down a coyote, tackled it, threw it in the trunk of my car, and had it in my bathroom downstairs when I was living with my mom and dad. Let me say, when my mom opened the bathroom door, I heard about it.
And in case it wasn't clear from that clip, despite his affection for the critters, Girod is against the ban on coyote hunting contests. He wants these contests to continue. Like a lot of the other Republicans, he said the contests are a way of life for rural Oregonians, as well as a practical way to get rid of a lot of coyotes at the same time. Now, it should be noted that even if the bill does pass the Oregon House, it would not change any laws relating to the hunting of coyotes, except for the fact that you couldn't have these competitions. They've had a number of these competitions in eastern Oregon over the past few years. They give away guns and cash prizes for killing the most coyotes in the course of a day or two. It passed the Senate narrowly, now heads to the House, and we'll see what happens from there. And just quickly, one other thing, getting back to a budget thing that relates to eastern Lane County, the Lieberg Fish Hatchery is not going to, at this point, remain open after the end of June. There was a last-ditch effort by some supporters to get a little bit more money added to the budget, but the Budget Ways and Means Committee decided not to include that money. So that hatchery, after nearly 70 years, will shut its doors at the end of June. But this is a big caveat here. Lawmakers say they're still working to find money for it. So, you know how I said there's still a few weeks left in the session? So there are a few weeks left for Lieberg Hatchery supporters to convince enough lawmakers to keep it open.
Yeah, I think that's important for a lot of people in the area. The Lieberg Hatchery is something that they really want to keep open. So it'll be interesting to see if they can make it happen.
It's a great place to visit, too. So just as a person who's been there a few times, I hope it stays open.
Well, before we head into our last segment, this week, a panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals heard arguments in a case brought by 21 young people against the federal government over climate change. Now, the basis of the lawsuit is that the government has known for decades that climate change is caused by fossil fuels and has encouraged the fossil fuel industry. Despite that, they say climate change endangers the future of these young people and violates their constitutional rights to life, liberty, and property. So at the hearing this week, Justice Department Attorney Jeff Clark told the judges the case is an attack on separation of powers. The administration has been trying everything it can to keep this case from going to trial. Attorney Julia Olson, who represents the youth plaintiffs, says the case is based on bedrock constitutional principles. Judge Andrew Hurwitz pushed back at Olson.
I'm sympathetic to the problems you point out, but you shouldn't say this is just an ordinary suit.
And Julia Olson summed up her arguments this way.
And we must be a nation that applies the rule of law to harmful government conduct that threatens the lives of our children so that they can grow up safe and free and pursue their happiness. And that is what the founders intended.
So this panel of judges will be issuing a decision in the future. They didn't really give a timeline, but the plaintiffs are really hoping that they'll decide to let the case go to trial, and that trial would take place here in Eugene at the federal courthouse with Judge Ann Aiken. So we'll see what happens.
These are very patient plaintiffs.
They really, it's
well, been... yeah, I mean, Kelsey Giuliano, who's the named plaintiff in the case, was, I think, 18 or 19 when it was filed in 2015, and now she's 23. The youngest plaintiff is 11 years old now, so he was a little kid when this was first filed in federal court.
Wow. And is there a timeline? Do you know, like, how long the decision? No.
It's really hard to know, but the judges did say that they would deliberate carefully. Again, you're listening to the Northwest Passage podcast. I'm Rachel McDonald with Brian Bull, Ani Katz, and Chris Lehman. And it's time for us to talk about what stuck with us this week in the news. Brian, you want to start?
One of the stories that took my fancy was a local story produced by Jess Burns. She had a great feature on firefighters and breathing in wood smoke from forest fires. And believe it or not, I was actually a firefighter myself, roughly 30 years and 50 pounds ago, for the National Park Service while I lived in Idaho. And I'll temper that by saying I only went out on one fire. It was a lightning-caused blaze, and I was putting out largely spot fires for about 17 hours by my count. When I got home at the end of that, though, my mouth, nose, and ears were gray for days on end. I brush my teeth. The toothbrush comes out gray. I run a Q-tip through my ear. It comes out charcoal black. So for just a 17-hour exposure to a wildfire that had largely burned over just doing spot fires, it was really a great illustration of how much contaminants that people on the line who work these lines and work these blazes goes through with little more than just perhaps a bandana over their mouth. Here from Jess Burns' feature is former firefighter Timothy Inglesby, who used to jump out choppers in the 80s and 90s, reflecting on what he didn't care to remember about his experience.
I tried to forget about all the forests I inhaled. I remember some seasons I had been so impacted by the smoke, I lost my sense of smell and taste for several months. It wasn't, until maybe the next spring it started coming back.
Inglesby went on to found the Eugene-based group Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology. He's one of a growing chorus of people urging more intensive research into the effects of breathing in so much smoke, which can contain things like formaldehyde, benzene, even herbicides that have been used on timber. The good news is that earlier this year, President Trump signed legislation to create a quote-unquote National Firefighter Registry to help the CDC track links between on-the-job exposure and cancer.
And just a fun fact, Timothy Inglesby is the father of Kelsey Giuliano, who's suing the federal government over climate change.
Small world.
Wow, that is a small world. That's crazy.
Small, increasingly warmer world.
Yeah.
Jeez. I guess. Wow.
Chris, I think it's your turn.
Sure. Well, this week, as lawmakers at the state capitol continued to debate the higher education budget and trying to keep tuition rates down at universities around the state, we had the story of a college student at Oregon State University who decided to leave school after his junior year to pursue a job. And while that might initially sound like the story of somebody who couldn't afford college anymore, the good news for Adley Richman was that he was selected as the number one draft pick in the Major League Baseball draft, and he'll be getting a signing bonus that might exceed $8 million. So if should he decide to come back to school, he can probably buy some very nice textbooks. This was of interest to me because, number one, he's a local guy. He's an Oregon born and raised, or at least grew up here in Oregon, and obviously went to Oregon State. I saw the Beavers baseball team play a few weeks ago. So that had a connection to me. And I grew up actually as a Baltimore Orioles fan, believe it or not. And I still listen to their games on the Major League Baseball app. So I'm interested in both in my Oregon connection and my East Coast connections. So go Beavers, go Orioles, and good luck in the big leagues, Adley.
My goodness. $8 million? That'll cover about a year's worth of textbooks.
Totally. Ani, you want to go next?
Yeah. on the podcast in the past, we have talked about the royal family. And of course, I have said that I am a major fan of them. And so we got a lot of exposure to the royal family this week because President Trump and several members of his family are in the UK and France, partially because it is the 75th anniversary today, June 6th, of D-Day. And so let's skip over all of the commentary on his dress wear at the gala that he attended with the Queen. There was a lot of fuss over the incorrect fitting of his suit. But not only do we get to hear a lot of the Queen this week, which is unusual, we don't usually get to hear her talk that much, but on Morning Edition today and yesterday, there were just some amazing firsthand accounts of from veterans of the D-Day events. And, you know, 75, I was thinking like, wow, this is getting a lot of coverage. And then I realized, oh, wow, this may be the last time that we hear from a lot of these men, because if you were listening, a lot of them are already in their 90s. And so I just really enjoyed listening to the histories that they gave and the memories that they had, which are all still very, you know, right in the front of their minds. And, you know, it was an interesting look back this morning.
I doubt we're going to see anyone hit the centennial mark in this group of people who stormed the beaches at Normandy. And one of the items I saw online was from Time. They actually had a 90-something-year-old veteran parachute, aided and assisted, of course, back onto the Normandy area to relive that jump. And he's spry. He's alert. And he remembers, and he and many other veterans are calling on others to continue beating to the drum, I guess, to maintain the freedom and liberty that so many sacrificed for on the beaches that day. It was just an epic invasion.
Well, I think especially because, you know, being in the United States, we hear so much about it from our perspective. And what I loved this morning is that they were talking to British soldiers. And there were also French people talking. And so, you know, I mean, it was the Allied forces altogether. And so it was really interesting just reliving some of their memories with them.
And I think that the coverage we've been hearing this week is definitely an example of what I love about public radio is when you do hear those firsthand accounts, those voices of these men who are in their 90s remembering that day. I also was struck by the coverage of Tiananmen Square's anniversary this week and hearing reporter Deborah Amos talking about covering it and also hearing some of the archive tape that she recorded in Tiananmen Square. Really good coverage from NPR this week.
And lastly, FBI case files have been opened from the 1970s about one of the most perplexing mysteries. Hint, it's not D.B. Cooper.
I was just going to say.
But someone with lots of fur and oversized shoes and is seen regularly across the country, especially the Pacific Northwest, but remains at large. I'm talking, of course, about Bigfoot. An Oregon man named Peter Byrne got the FBI to test some hair back in 1976 to see if it was indeed Sasquatch. The short of it is no, it was deer fur. Mr. Byrne, now 93, says he's undeterred and is still committed to finding evidence of Bigfoot, a.k.a. Sasquatch, the Yeti, the Skunk Ape, Harry, friend of the Hendersons. The FBI has politely asserted that it commits its resources, though, to criminal investigations. But obviously, someone in the chain of command was sympathetic to this request.
Brian, that sounds like one of those stories on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, where you have to decide whether it's true or not.
Totally.
You know, I'll listen in this Saturday. I wouldn't be surprised if they pick up on this.
You should tweet it, Peter Sagal.
Well, that wraps up this week's edition of the Northwest Passage. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rachel McDonald, KLCC News Director.
I'm Morning Edition host Annie Katz.
I'm reporter Brian Bull.
And I'm reporter Chris Lehman.
The Northwest Passage will be off next week, but we'll be back the week after. So thanks so much for joining us.